Welcome to Recovering Evangelicals, a podcast for people who were once very comfortable in the Christian faith until the 21st century intruded and made it very hard to keep on believing. I'm your host, Luke Jansen.
And I'm Scott Dyer.
We've covered a lot of topics in this podcast over the past several years, and each episode we release, as long and as in-depth as we try to be, that every episode leaves a few things hanging, things that we call loose threads. Over the past couple months, I stumbled across an article on the web that brought together loose threads from three completely separate sets of episodes, episodes that otherwise had nothing to do with each other. The first of these three groups of episodes was our many interviews with people who have broken free from an evangelical faith and who still call themselves spiritual but not religious, rather than just simple, plain, straight-up atheists. Often they would talk about now having a greater appreciation for life. They would describe a deeply felt awe when they looked at nature, the night sky, or a sunrise. Life itself was just that much more beautiful and precious, and they felt a bit more connected with humanity. A couple months ago, we talked to Sarah Hayward, and near the end of our conversation with her, around the 58-minute mark, I read an excerpt from her book to the audience, an experience that she had long after having given up her belief in God, a profound awe that she felt at a sunset one day when she was coming home from work. And other guests as well have described similar feelings of a new kind of awe and wonder, even though they've left spirituality entirely.
You know, it's common to our humanity. You know, I think I've heard, for example, Richard Dawkins a number of times say that if he could have any religion at all, it would be kind of the religion of Spinoza. And what he means by that is that Spinoza had this kind of sense of awe at the complexity and orderliness and especially mathematically of the universe, right? And so he developed really a kind of faith, but totally impersonal, you know, not a personal God or anything like that, but just kind of a faith based on that awe, I think, that you're speaking of, that it breaks through in strange moments in people's lives. I know for myself, that's the case, that I can only think of a few, but I've had a few of those moments, and they've been kind of random, like all of a sudden it just, you know, so anyway, yeah.
So I said there's three sets of episodes, and that's the first one, people who have deconverted entirely, but still want to, you know, they still see themselves as spiritual, but not religious. There's a second, another set of loose threads. It goes back to one of the first episodes we did. It was my own deconstruction journey. I talked about all the reasons why I began to set aside this part of my evangelical faith or that one, various tenets here and there, and I won't list them all again. Interested listeners can go back to episode number 2 if they really want to hear the full story. But there was one thing that kept me from rejecting everything about my faith, and paradoxically, it was science and my career in medical research. As I learned about the intricacy of the cell, the complexity of the genetic code, and the intricacy of the nanomachines just shuttling around through the cell, I was overwhelmed. I was awestruck. And there's that word again. I used a minute ago in Sarah's story, looking at the sunset, the word awe. It just seemed too hard to think that this was all the product of a super cosmic accident. And so I couldn't give up the idea of what I began to call a creative life force. Something, not necessarily someone, but at least a something, something far bigger than anything I could imagine that was behind the constant evolution of the explosion produced by the Big Bang into a universe full of complexity and beauty and life. And here's the thing. This is why I want to pursue this question of awe. In telling that story to listeners in this podcast or to individuals over coffee or to crowds in churches, I'll acknowledge that this sounds too much like God of the Gaps thinking. And how it bugs me, it annoys me, it embarrasses me that the dying faith I still had was rescued by this conviction that there's a creative life force. But I couldn't change that fact. It just seemed a little bit more likely, a little bit more believable that there was some kind of a driving force, a creative life force, even an undiscovered creative law of nature, than to think it was pure accident. And it still bugs me. I still have this inner turmoil because I know it looks an awful lot like God of the Gaps thinking. I don't call it that because I'm still fully behind scientists someday finding that undiscovered creative law of nature. But there you go. Ah.
Well, I don't know what I can say to that. But I know what you mean as far as it's almost like you have to work hard to not think that there's something. You know, and I guess that's why religion in general is just endemic to humanity. You know, it's just hard to find a society that doesn't have some sort of religious tradition and so on. And I'm not saying that that's not a proof of
No,
religion.
not at all. No.
No, and I'm not saying that it is, but that sense of that there's something bigger than ourselves, and the more science seems to reveal to us, the more we do learn, it doesn't get less mysterious. You know, it doesn't get less awe-inspiring. It gets more awe-inspiring.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like you just the rabbit hole never ends.
Yeah, it's true.
You know, and that's fascinating. And yeah, and you know, the other thing I was going to mention as well is that it seems that the universe doesn't compel belief. You know, like that used to be the old apologetic line was that, you know, to look at nature, to look at the universe, it compels you to believe. You just have no choice but to be, you know. And I don't think that's true. You could look at the cosmos and nature and so on, and you can look at it as a non-believing person or as an atheist, and there's nothing compelling about it that says you must believe. It's a matter of it is interpretation. It is the framework that you bring to it. Whether you're going to look at it one way or the other way, I think comes down to a choice. You know, you choose to look at it one way or the other way. I don't think there's necessarily anything that compels you to choose one of those.
Right.
It's just right. You know what I mean?
Yep.
It's just that you do choose one. And so I think in a lot of ways, if you were talking about atheism versus theism, I think we're kind of both in the same place in a lot of ways. I think we're both in the same sense that we have to make a choice. The atheist makes a choice in their direction because they feel the evidence is, and the Christian makes a choice. But I don't think either is compelled to make
Right.
that choice, if
Yeah.
you understand what I'm saying.
Yep, totally.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's the second example that I gave for where I saw these loose threads that were coming together. There's a third one. We did quite a series on intelligent design, a dozen episodes, drilling down on the whole idea of intelligent design and coming to the firm conclusion that we're not convinced by the proponents. We just couldn't buy into the idea. But we began to wonder why these clearly intelligent, scientifically minded proponents, why they were embracing this idea so tightly. They were cherry picking. We talked about how they were cherry picking data to support ideas. They were always appealing to incredible statistical probabilities, quoting numbers that just make your jaw drop and leave you awestruck. And again, there's that word awe. They were so convinced that this had to point to something way beyond human. I can't begin to count how many times I've heard Dr. James Tour say, "We just can't do this in the lab. We even with the most expensive equipment, we just can't do this." You know, there's that appeal to
Right.
something much, much bigger than us. So,
Right. Yeah. Well, I think it kind of relates back to what I just said about being compelled. I think that they're looking for something that's impossible to explain materialistically, because the feeling is if it's impossible to explain based on materialism, then that proves God, right? And I think that's what they're trying to do. And a few hundred years ago, they did that by challenging the whole notion of evolution. But I think what's happened is that evolutionary theory is so well proven now that unless you're going to be kind of a, and I'm going to say it, kind of a nutty creationist, and I'm sorry, I think that those super conservative creationists like Ken Ham are like flat earthers as far as I'm concerned.
right.
So I think barring that stance, then the only other possibility is to try to somehow accommodate evolution by saying, okay, well, evolution's true, but there's these gaps in it that can only be explained by a designer, you know, guiding it or whatever. It to me, it's just I get the sincerity of it and the reasons for it, I just can't buy into that.
Exactly. So these were a whole series of episodes, the intelligent design one, my own deconstruction story, and then the many people that we've interviewed who have, left evangelicalism. All of these episodes with the one of the loose threads that was hanging in all of them was this idea of awe, that we were all somehow being motivated by the emotion of awe. And it was only a short while ago I stumbled across some articles on the internet, or maybe it was a YouTube video, I forget, a TED Talk or something, but it was about the role that the emotion of awe plays in religious and spiritual experiences. And that brought all those episodes and that idea of awe together in my head. I thought, okay, we need to do this. I found out that psychologists are now starting to pay a lot more attention to this emotion of awe and its importance for promoting cognitive and emotional wellness. I found out that the Templeton Foundation has invested a significant amount of money into getting people to explore this emotion of awe and how it plays into the formation of a spiritual experience or a religious worldview. And so I thought, okay, this is something I really wanted to look into.
Yeah, well, that took me by surprise a bit, especially the stuff about, you know, the Templeton Foundation spending so much effort in that direction and so on. But I think through listening to the various people we've interviewed and looking at some of the material that you've uncovered and so on, it's really kind of reinvigorated. I've always had that interest, but it's kind of reinvigorated my own interest in the subject. Yeah.
Okay. So we've got a couple scholars lined up to talk to us about this, but before we bring them in, I thought that you and I, Scott, we would just put down a little bit of a foundation, just help the listeners to put some of the pieces of our discussion into place. Our experts might use some technical jargon, or they might talk about things that the listener may not have pondered before. And so I thought we can just talk generally about this to give the listeners a framework that really helps to put the pieces into place as they come out with our scholars. So the first thing I thought that we need to do is to define what the emotion of awe is, at least how psychologists will describe it. And I've been rooting around through quite a few papers written by psychologists, and Templeton released this document they call the white paper, the summary of the study that we've been just mentioning very briefly here. And all of this literature on awe keeps referring to two key ingredients in the emotion of awe. And those two key ingredients are, first, a perceived vastness, and the second is a need for accommodation. Now let's break those down, those two down. First, the perceived vastness. This often refers to the size or magnitude of things that inspires awe. You know, you stand at the edge of the Grand Canyon, you look up at a starry night sky, you listen to the roar of Niagara Falls. You stand at the foot of a 350-foot redwood tree that's got a hole cut in its base for a car to drive through, literally. In all those cases, you're going to drop your jaw and you're going to feel awe just from the vastness of the thing you're experiencing. Scott, do you remember the opening scene in the very first Star Wars movie after those immortal words drifted off into space a long time ago in a galaxy far away, and then a little ship speeds across the screen from the right, and then you see some laser blasts, and then you see the front end of this attacking ship coming in from the right, just getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and it just fills the entire screen. Do you remember that scene?
Oh, absolutely. It's a brilliant scene.
And what did you feel at that time?
Well, yeah, you do feel awe. You feel that sense of just, to use a word that isn't a word, hugeness.
Yeah. I remember seeing that on a big screen, I don't know, 100-foot size screen, and just seeing the ship just keep on getting bigger and bigger and just filling the screen. It was palpable. It was a feeling, and that is awe.
Yeah.
But it doesn't only have to be size that evokes awe. It can be the overwhelming prestige of a person. You know, like how some people get emotionally overwhelmed when they suddenly see a rock star or a political leader standing in front of them. Mm. You remember those scenes we saw of the Beatles or of Elvis stepping off the planes and the people just going crazy? That's also, you know, what would some of us do if we just suddenly bumped into Taylor Swift?
Yeah,
all of a sudden she's right there. You know, what would you do? That's awe. Or the perceived vastness can be something more artistic in nature. It might pertain to the intricacy and complexity of what you're looking at. Some people get gobsmacked by the Mona Lisa. I've got to be honest, it doesn't do that much for me. But, you know, some people might be in awe of the Queen's jewel-studded crown or the intricacy of a computer program, probably you, Scott. The complexity of the genetic code or the nanomachinery inside the cell. These also can evoke awe.
Yeah, for sure. All those things you've mentioned, I've had that experience.
Right.
Yeah.
So all of those have this idea, this element of vastness, you know, just the magnitude of this thing. But there is that second component that psychologists look for when they study awe. They say that it needs to provoke a need for accommodation. In their words, it has to violate one's normal understanding of the world and provoke an attempt to change the mental structures that one uses to understand the world. That's how they would say it. You and I would just simply say it has to blow your mind. When you're standing at the foot of that 100-meter redwood tree, that forces a whole new mental structure for the word tree. The Grand Canyon, Niagara Falls, the starry night sky, these all completely stretch your mental understanding of physical space. You have to develop a new concept of physical space. That opening scene in Star Wars blows your mental structure of the word starship.
Yeah.
Before that scene, I mean, I was raised on Star Trek, and they
Yeah.
just had tiny little ships. And when this thing came on the screen, it blew the mental construct of a starship.
Right.
So, another thing psychologists will say about awe, they'll often talk about the physiological and cognitive effects that awe has on us. Physiologically, your heart rate might go up. You might gasp or start breathing faster, maybe. You might get goosebumps on your arms. The hairs on your neck might stand up. You might feel a chill. You might feel warmth. Picture some little girl who's just bumped into Taylor Swift and they're just frantically fanning their face. They're so overwhelmed with heat, right? It's you feel the heat or a chill or what have you. So those are physiological responses, but there's also cognitive or emotional changes. You suddenly feel smaller, very small. Again, just think about how you feel at the Grand Canyon under the starry night sky or in the presence of Taylor Swift. You just feel small. That's one of the effects of awe. Now, along with this feeling, we've talked about the physiological responses, and now we're talking a little bit about the cognitive responses. Along with this feeling of self-diminishing, feeling smaller, there might also be an increased connectedness with other people or with the deity. The way one psychologist put it, awe often puts people in a self-transcendent state where they focus less on themselves and feel more like a part of the bigger whole. A great example of what we're talking about here would be astronauts. What some have said when they fly into space and look back on Earth, they suddenly feel overwhelmed with emotion, the vastness of space and the beauty of Earth and how small they are. And then they suddenly have a whole new mental structure for the word humanity, and they suddenly feel more connected to everyone on the planet. This is all awe, and some might call that a spiritual experience.
Yeah, it's interesting that first photograph that you may have seen it, many people have seen it, of Earth from the moon, and that changed humanity's framework. I mean, that was the first time that we as a species had ever seen ourselves from a distance, from outside, right? And talk about an awe-inspiring experience and how that can cognitively affect, I think that had an effect on all of us to see the world in a very different way than we had ever before.
Right.
Yeah.
So we're going to talk to a couple experts about this emotion of awe and how it might play into all those episodes that I mentioned that we've already done that look at various aspects of spiritual and religious experiences and just play around with some of those ideas. But we thought we'd first let you, the listeners, hear from someone who's had a life-changing awe experience, a testimonial, a personal testimonial, if you will. A few weeks ago, North America experienced a full solar eclipse. In the lead up to that event, a literal cosmic event, I came across an article in our national news feed, the CBC, an article about solar eclipses and the profound effect these can have on people. And that article then linked me to a person, one of the people who have had these experiences, David Makepeace. He had a life-changing experience during a solar eclipse roughly a decade ago, and he's been chasing eclipses ever since. I will have links in the show notes to his bio and his web pages. He's got some truly great videos and articles there. I recommend you look at them. But here is an excerpt of the conversation that we had with David and that whole life-changing experience. So, David, let's first just establish the context, some of the relevant details around this experience that you'll be telling us about. What was your frame of mind before the event? Who were you with? When and where was this? And maybe if there was anything of this, what was your spirituality at that point before the first eclipse?
I think before my first eclipse, I didn't really have a sense of my own spiritual nature or my own soulfulness. I don't think I'd had any, subjective experiences in which to sort of have a context for those things. I had, of course, heard about my soul, my spirit, my presence, and I'd read some things, but I didn't really have a personal sense of it. But I was very curious about the universe. I'd always loved stargazing and astronomy, and I was certainly involved in looking at the stars and, wondering about what we're doing out here, as many people do, under a beautiful star field. But then the opportunity came up to see a total solar eclipse. There was a woman that I was involved with who went down to Baja, Mexico to help with all the travel arrangements for the big eclipse in 1991. And she invited me a couple of weeks before the eclipse, thinking, "Wow, I've learned a lot about what this eclipse is going to be like, and I think David would really enjoy this." So she invited me down, and I booked a flight to La Paz in Baja, and we drove to this hilltop on the day of the eclipse and just waited for the shadow of the moon to arrive. So I was fascinated with the idea of that. I loved watching the moon. And as I say, I love watching the stars at night, but I didn't really have a sense of what was about to happen because as nobody does before you see a total eclipse of the sun. So.
And you said you didn't have a sense of what was about to happen. Had you been talking to people who had said, oh, you just wait, you're going to feel this way, you're going to see this and that. Was there any of that kind of thing?
No, you know, there really wasn't, other than the just sort of general understanding that a person has from, you know, folklore as you're growing up, that these things are really neat, they're kind of mystical, they're dangerous, you have to be careful. I learned that I needed a proper welder's glass or some eclipse glasses to view the partial phases. But I really didn't have any other eclipse chasing friends. I knew no one who had seen a total eclipse. And it was really just the mystique of going somewhere exotic to be with somebody that I wanted to be with. And, oh, on the side, there was going to be this total eclipse of the sun, which I thought might be really cool. So it was kind of like third on the list of things to do in Baja, Mexico back in 1991.
So then we come to the moments immediately before, during, and after the eclipse. Describe what you experienced. And perhaps tease apart what you were feeling emotionally, but also cognitively and physically inside your body and outside your body, and then possibly spiritually.
When you're standing anywhere on the earth as the shadow of the moon is approaching you seconds before a total eclipse, there is a rising sense of energy and excitement as you've been following the moon blocking the sun with your special glasses for the last 90 minutes or so. And in the last couple of minutes, as the sun has been reduced to a tiny sliver and then a tiny little point that you're seeing through your welder's glass, when you stop looking and you look down to the environment and you see the shadow of the moon, you know, it's only like a mile or two away from you. It looks like there's a gigantic storm coming because all of a sudden, you know, towards the west, the shadow of the moon is actually there. It's being projected off the moon and it's made it all the way through space and it's hit the ground. And now it's about to engulf the location where you're standing. You know, that the excitement of that, of being present for the universe happening in its clockwork motion in the first person, I can't properly describe what that feels like. The amount of excitement and the rush of, oh my God, like I'm here, we're on this planet, we're flying through space, like all of that stuff, all of a sudden it starts to occur to you, whereas it hadn't occurred to me before. So the best way to describe the sort of my state of mind was just a sense of incredible excitement, as if any moment I'm going to go over the top of this hill and we're going to go down the ride on the other side. It was that type of a building tension, a fabulous tension and anticipation of all of these cosmic forces coming together with me standing in the middle, as if any moment I was actually going to be involved in this thing, which I love. I love that. And then, of course, the moment that the shadow of the moon finally arrives at your location and engulfs where you are, the sun disappears completely, it automatically triggers a complete change of the environment. You're standing in the dark shadow of the moon. The sky becomes a deep azure blue. Stars and planets become visible. There's an orange glow on the horizon for 360 degrees all around you. And then when you look up this long cone of moon shadow up into the sky, you see the dark disk of the dark side of the moon lined up perfectly with the surface of the sun, revealing the sun's atmosphere, known as the corona. And this is the most unearthly sight you could possibly imagine. In the years since, I've called it the phantasmal vision, because it is like it's like a crab or a flower, and there's these streamers and these brush shapes coming off the surface of the sun behind this black disk like this, and it's just shooting in every direction. And it's instantaneously overwhelming because you've never seen an object like this before. And of course, all of your senses realize that this is happening in space. I'm looking to the surface of the sun. There's pink gas shooting off the surface of the sun and these pink things called prominences. And all of this is happening simultaneously. And your world has been just completely transformed. So for me, there was this moment of complete suspension. Like I have actually no state of mind at this point, and it is all just perception. I'm not even thinking about what it is. All I'm doing is gathering data. So like I'm in that mode of things. I don't think I had a thought. I'm just, oh, yeah. And there was this rising sense of absolutely everything. It was utterly exciting. There was a sense of awe and wonder at how could this possibly be so beautiful? How could this be so powerful? How could the place that I was standing a few minutes ago, which seemed to be a normal hill and a normal place in the world, all of a sudden be transformed into, like, you know, the center of the solar system? How could my awareness have so quickly been shifted from a regular two-dimensional type of regular day to something so unearthly and three-dimensional? It affected me very, very powerfully. And for those 6.5 minutes that I was in the shadow of the moon, that just seemed to be a fleeting instant of just that one sense of this rising energy of awareness and fascination and awe and wonder, which in future years led me to look up peak experience. And then I read all kinds of stuff about peak experience from Maslow and all that, and realized that that's exactly what that was. But at the time, I didn't understand that. And then the minute that the shadow of the moon left our location and the sun returned, and there was the diamond ring that heralds the return of the daylight, and the shadow of the moon moves off of you, I was just absolutely gobsmacked, completely gobsmacked at what I had just seen, what I had just felt. The elation, I mean, it was like a switch had been thrown, and I was all of a sudden somebody completely different than I had been before. I knew something now that I didn't know before about being here on this planet and about what it meant to be a human. And it took the next couple of days of hanging around the Sea of Cortez, just sitting by the beach and watching pelicans diving into the water for fish, of just pondering my own existence. How could I be out here in the universe? And I had this, afterwards, I had this sense. I remember the first thing that was different was that I thought I had seen myself or an aspect of myself somehow. I remember that was the very first big thing that I felt in the hours afterwards. And that was so compelling. How could it have been possible?
Yeah, if I may, David, before we get too far in what happened over the next few days, I still want to stick just for a minute in the moment of that awe and wonder that you were experiencing. I wanted to hear a little bit more about how you now perceived yourself in the context of the universe, for example.
Well, it was, as I say, there was a rising action. There was a sense of lift and sort of elation, excitement, awe, wonder. So there was a lift. There was a sense that I was at the right place at the right time, that I was meant to be here, that I was closer to fulfilling my potential than I ever was before. I mean, all the things that Maslow then later talks about. So there was all of that suspended. I was not aware of time passing, which was a huge thing. I mean, they say this in the eclipse chasing world, all eclipses, regardless of their duration, lasts 8 seconds. Because that's exactly what it feels like. Doesn't matter how long the eclipse is, it will be 8 seconds, because there's this odd sort of noetic quality to being in the shadow of the moon that just sort of suspends all of the normal passage of time. And you seem to be out of your mind and simply just a perceiving gathering of this data, these feelings, these perceptions, before I had a chance to think about it.
Did you feel overwhelmed by your context, by the universe? Did you feel smaller? Or did you feel perhaps more in touch with the universe?
A lot of people have told me that the eclipse experience does make them feel small and insignificant, and what a gigantic universe it is, and what a small little ant type of person I am. And for me, it's the exact opposite. I felt in tune with the universe. I felt that my nature was this big. I felt the bigness of it. And I felt that I was a part of that, and that somehow by perceiving it, I was taking part in it and helping to create the thing in the first place. That was my take. I didn't go the insignificant, oh, it's, I'm just a little thing over here and look at all this big thing. I didn't separate. I integrated. That was
okay.
An instantaneous thing. As I say, I was not prepared, but that was my take on it. And it's been that way ever since.
Okay. So now you were beginning to describe the more long-lasting effects, not just for those few minutes, but for days, weeks, years, even afterwards?
Yes, days, weeks, years. Or of course, when the eclipse was over, I wanted to see another one straight away, because I hadn't figured out what it was that happened here. In those days and weeks afterwards, I wanted to chase eclipses immediately. I needed to see another one, because I knew that the few short minutes in totality just were not enough. So of course I did become an eclipse chaser, and I ruminated and digested and sort of meditated on the things that I felt and how I felt when I was in totality. Cause I wasn't necessarily feeling those things the same way anymore, now that I was sort of a flat earther again, going about my regular life. It was like, I wanted that lift. I wanted that reinforcement from the universe again, that I am it, and that I am that I can feel those things as a human, because I felt that they were so positive and so healthy, and they grounded me, and I was excited by it, and I wanted to be a part of the world, but I'd never had that motivation before. So knowing that that was out there somewhere in the universe, and that I could align myself with an eclipse again, since they are so predictable, I just aligned my life around continuing to go to every total eclipse that I possibly could for the next 33 years. And then in those experiences, start to work with it as material in my own personal growth to try to understand why did I love it so much? What was actually happening to me as a person, as a soul, as a spirit, as a nervous system during totality? Why was it so impactful for me enough to change the course of my life?
So it made you ask a lot of questions. How about did you reevaluate any things in your life, your priorities, your values? Did you make decisions that you'd never anticipated making?
Well, like becoming an eclipse chaser for the next 33 years, I would say yes. I would say yes, because now the priority was getting out into the world to see total eclipses. Now the priority was not buying a house. It was not getting married and having children and getting an RSP together, which is the conventional approach. I had no interest in those things. If I made $5,000, then it was $5,000 towards eclipse chasing.
You know, it's interesting hearing you talk about all this, and fascinating. But one of the things, just in light of what you just have been saying, is you sound, in some senses, I don't mean to be glib, but almost like the, you know, that first time, you know, the heroin addict who talks about their first hit, and then the rest of their addiction is chasing that hit, you know, trying to find that same. And of course, they can never achieve it because of our physiology. Or the near-death experience. People often find that life-changing and say the same thing, that they're, everything now becomes relative, like their whole life, their whole perspective changes. So it's just those parallels are fascinating.
Yeah, there's no question there that there are parallels to those things. And in each of those cases, there's a veil that's been lifted of one or another. All of a sudden, with drugs, you feel like you're the best you that you've ever been, albeit it's artificial and only lasts couple of hours and you got to do it again. So there's a destructive part to all of that, but psychologically, in the way that you feel like you've really come into yourself, you're Santa Claus and the Lone Ranger all rolled into one. You're the best possible you that there is, you know. But in all those cases, the near-death experience, haven't had one, but I understand that that's also lifting a veil on what the truth actually is in our lives. That there is some kind of entity that is long lasting, that there is somewhere that you go after the body dissolves and after the individual, you know, Davidness is, you know, no longer required, and you sort of see into the bigness and the truth of what the universe really is all about. You know, that a veil has been lifted. So my version is similar to that, in that this thing is a cosmic vision. Like, you know, and I'm not the only one. This has been happening for centuries. Shakespeare wrote about it. It's changed the course of history. Emperors and kings have seen these things and used them to their advantage on the battlefield because they were predictable. And if, you know, I have the universe on my side, I'll make the sun disappear. Don't do what I tell you to. And there's numerous examples of this. So humans have been exposed to this and have been changed by it pretty much since the beginning of time. So I'm just another one of those soldiers.
And how about your perception towards other people? Did any of that change? Or maybe this is a similar question. Did it make you start to think differently along spiritual lines?
Well, not the typical packaged religions, other than, you know, I mean, so I've been doing this for 33 years. So a lot has happened in those 33 years along my personal development. In the first 10 years or so, I knew that it was something important, and I loved the travel and I loved being there when the shadow of the moon swept over me. But I didn't really have that context to put it in terms that this was, the beginning of some spiritual growth and providing some spiritual direction for me in my life, which I think all of us need to one extent or another. But perhaps our society doesn't really encourage those things, particularly doesn't really give us that many outlets to go and experience those things. So I was sort of on my own to understand what that was. And then over many years, I started to read books and I started to read Buddhism and a lot of the Eastern wisdom traditions. And I got into yoga and I got into breathing techniques and I got into a mindfulness and understanding, you know, exactly what am I? Like, what is that's going on here? What, you know, what was this rising action during totality? And then I discovered Maslow and the peak experience, and that this was a fairly well understood, well documented experience where you feel closer to truth, closer to beauty. There's a sense of fulfilling your own potential. There's this rising action and a sense of expanded self, and you're no longer aware of time. Like all of these things that happened to me during totality, I found were actually well understood and already described by somebody back in the 60s who looked at this. So I find that very interesting. So I started to go along that path and try to understand what had happened to me in the context of peak experience. And then as the decades unfolded, I realized that I had also had a shift in terms of realizing the interconnectedness of all things, and that I started to see the world in terms of their interconnected nature, the weave of everything, me included, you know. An example of that that I love to give, and of course, David Suzuki helped us with this, you know, for years in his great show, The Nature of Things, helping us to understand that you are air, you are fire, you are water, you are soil. And he did episodes on these things, trying to, you know, dispel the illusion that you're separate from everything and show the connections that you have between things. And this was a great description of what my experience had been, that I felt so a part of the universe, not separate from it anymore. So my growth went from peak experience to the realization of interconnectedness to then the third stage for me was this, the resulting effect on my identity. Because if I actually was part of the fiber of the universe and I was noticing the interconnectedness of all things everywhere, then I was no longer little Dave Makepeace who was born in Montreal and loves to do this. My little narrative all of a sudden was only a part of my avowed identity. And I actually started to include the universe in when I thought about myself, because obviously I'm a part of the total functioning universe. And that stage three of it was a shift in my identity. So I no longer saw myself as being separate from the universe, but a part of the total universe. And of course, this is a 15 or 20 year journey. So, and I loved Carl Sagan's quote, which I used in my film, Still Hooked, which is, we are a way for the universe to know itself. And then and that all started to make sense to me as well, because of course we're made out of little bits and pieces of Big Bang. All of us sitting here right now is what the Big Bang is doing 14 billion years later, right? There's no, and that's just factual. It's not mystical. This is what the Big Bang is doing. All of us three sitting right here, the Big Bang is doing this. So if that's true, then we're all bits and pieces of Big Bang. All the carbon and the iron floating around in my body now that came from stars that exploded a long time ago connect us all to the deep past of the cosmos. And we are now an aspect of that. This sound of my voice is what the universe sounds like. When you speak and I hear you, the universe is hearing the voice. When I smell an orange or a grape, the universe is smelling that. So I no longer separate myself perceptually and functionally from the universe. It totally integrated. And I feel that's why I call myself Pitchman for the universe. Because you know, I'm trying to make people realize that you actually are a functioning aspect of this total thing. And what an amazing job that is for a person. It's amazing.
So the subsequent experiences after that first peak experience, did you find those similar, or was it kind of like that analogy of the heroin addict, you know, that the second time wasn't quite as, you know, it's that first time thing, right?
Or a deepening effect, maybe.
Or the opposite of that, right? Like, so, yeah.
Yeah. So it's almost like returning to Mecca. There was never a disappointment.
Okay.
There were one or two of them out of the 17 total eclipses that I've seen. One or two of them were partially clouded out, so there was a little bit of a diminishment of the amount of corona that I'd seen and stuff like that. Which it's neither here nor there, because all kinds of stuff happens in the sky, and if there's a cloud, you can see the shadow of the moon rushing in and then rushing out on top of those clouds. So you're still part of this clockwork motion that I love to show up for. That gives me that connected sense. But it was almost like at that stage. Or leave the total eclipse being perfect, because I love knowing that I've committed to show up for the thing, you know, and building my life around showing up to do it. And as there's that great quote from the Julia Cameron book, the universe will reward you for taking risks on its behalf. And that affected me greatly as well, because I really feel that by showing up for it, whether we have clouds on the day or not, that it's a meaningful thing to do.
Right.
So one thing that comes to mind, we especially amongst the more materialist community, talk about how impersonal the universe is. What I hear you saying is that No, the universe is very personal because it's because I make it personal. In other words, I am the personality, in a sense, of the universe. That's a really interesting concept, I think.
Yes. I mean, and I've also read in the wisdom traditions from the East that, that the universal is the personal. And when you start looking at the metaphors around that, I think there's no question that that is the case. But a lot of our the reality that, that we experience, I mean, the thing I like to use for this is the roller coaster. I'll go on, take a couple spins around the roller coaster, absolutely love it, and I get back in line. Somebody else goes on and it makes them feel sick and they never want to see that roller coaster again. So what is the roller coaster? Right. So it is both things and it's neither. So it's one of those sort of paradox things. The things aren't just objectively what they are. They're what you make them by the way that you filter to these things.
Mm-hmm.
It is my reality to some extent. It is my universe as the universe is your universe. And Scotty, mm-hmm. and then you have your universe by the way that we cognize and filter and then, you know, digest the things that have happened to us. So I don't think the universe is a sort of objectively beautiful or inclusive or any of those things. If I see magic and mystery and miracles everywhere, then that's what my life is, because that's how I'm filtering those things. And ergo, that is what my life is about.
Okay, so we've far exceeded the window of time that you've given us, David. Is there anything that you want to finish off and leave us with before we say goodbye?
Well, I think in terms of the emotion of awe, which I think is the focus here, being excited by life and being excited by being here, especially in the context of realizing that you are the universe in the form of a human nervous system and that you belong here. You were grown here. You were not thrown here. To understand that that is a sort of a job that you're doing, to be the perceiver on the part of the universe, and that there is a partnership there to some extent. If that is a part of awe that can come from this sort of cosmic experience, I think it's one of the most healthful and helpful things that could possibly happen, because it has made me happier and just more fulfilled and much more willing to participate in my life and to show up for my relationships and all that sort of stuff, and to move in a state of wonder and gratitude at just how incredible this experience is.
Okay, so we're going to leave links in our show notes for how our listeners can find you, your work. There's some great videos there I highly recommend. David, I forgot to ask it. Have you written any books on this experience?
I have not. And okay. As a filmmaker, my first impulse is to go out and put cameras everywhere and shoot this thing and to get it in front of people, especially in the age of tech and media that we live in, that I've sort of grown up with. So my first impulse is always to make films. And with Hooked on the Shadow, and then 20 years later, still Hooked, that the two films sort of aim to help promote this experience and to show what's happening to eclipse chasers. That's been my way of handling some of the subject matter.
Okay. Thank you so much, David, for giving us your time. I know that you're getting ready to catch a plane. So I thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David.
Okay. Thank you, David.
My pleasure.
Scott, when you listen to David describe this experience and how it changed his life, I can't help but think this is fundamentally not different from the experience of someone who responds to the altar call. I've got air quotes here, responds to the altar call at an evangelical revival meeting or a youth retreat and comes back from that completely changed. What did you think?
But yeah, I totally agree. As you know, Luke, I love nature and I read quite a bit of nature writing, particularly writings of people like Emerson and so on. And to hear them, and these were not religious people. I mean, Emerson, that's a different story, but generally these aren't religious people, right? But to hear them describe their experiences of nature and kind of the overwhelmingness of it all and so on is very much akin to what I've heard described many times by Christians within religious context. You know, it's that experience of transcendence, I get, is the way I might put it. So I think there are definitely parallels there.
And even the way, to the extent that he suddenly found he had a whole new mission in life, this changed his life's priorities, gave him a whole new mission.
Yeah. Yeah, that part of it was kind of surprising in a way to me, like, because I think a lot of people who have those experiences don't come away thinking that, you know, think it's not necessarily life changing in the sense that they only changes the direction of their life or they have a new mission. So obviously that experience for him was more
profound, I think, maybe than maybe for some others, you know?
Yeah. The way he said, I haven't got the exact wording, but he said how it changed his priorities. Suddenly the priority was not to buy a house or get married, to have kids or get an RSP to get together. He said, he quoted those three things, but now it was all about getting enough money for the next trip to experience another eclipse. And, you know, that when he said that, that reminded me of my own experience just a year or two after myself diving headfirst into born again evangelical experience. I kid you not, suddenly I was questioning whether I should go to university. Up until that point, I had spent the first 20 years of my life getting ready to go to med school and become a surgeon. That's what I thought I was going to be. And my whole life was about getting to that point. And now suddenly, with this born-again Christian evangelical experience, I was questioning totally whether I should go to university or even to get married, because we were so convinced that the second coming of Christ was any day now. So why waste time getting ready for a career or family life? And quite frankly, it embarrasses me now to think about that part of my life.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's lots of examples of that happening to people. I mean, you think of the Apostle Paul, for example, who has this experience and completely changes his life, completely changes his mission, and he dedicates everything to, you know, carrying out this new mission that he believes he has been commissioned to do. And I can say for myself as well that when I had a similar kind of experience, in my case, it definitely that's what happened. Within a month, I went from kind of being a streetwise kind of guy doing a lot of dope and just and not doing very well in life, to entering a seminary with a bunch of people that I thought were the dullest, straightest people that I'd ever. I mean, these were the guys.
At that time, you were thinking that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, these were, okay. I'll never forget one of the first classes I went to. And I looked at this one guy and I thought, man, you know, that's the guy. I would have beat that guy up in school. Like, you know what I mean? Like, these were the opposite to everything that I thought at the time was cool. So it was a radical shift for sure.
So we're saying that it sounds, there's a lot of similarities between what David experienced and what both you and I and others who have had a spiritual or religious experience, there's a lot of similarities. David said something else that had me thinking to what extent we should be doing this or not, whether this is part of the Christian life. David was talking about how he now felt a whole new connection with the universe, and I guess to some extent humanity, but he really talked a lot about being connected to the universe. And he talked about how he now felt he was a part of the universe that was the physically sensing part of the universe, amongst other things. I mean, he also talked about how he came from the universe, from the Big Bang. But he said, now when I taste an orange, that's the Big Bang tasting the orange. And when I see a sunset, that's the universe experiencing the sunset through me. And that's him speaking. And so when we asked him at the end there, we said, do you have something for our listeners, something that they might want to apply? He said, he was emphasizing that they, you, the listeners, should realize that they have a job to be the perceiver on the part of the universe, that it's a partnership that you have with the universe. And I was wondering, to what extent can we be talking the same way from a Christian point of view? God's experienced the world through us. What do you think?
Well, I think it's really intriguing. And I think it's something that we don't think about very often. We think the opposite. We kind of think that we communicate God to the universe, to others, primarily through love, and that's fine. But you don't hear the opposite very often. Somebody has said, we are kind of the universe become conscious of itself, in a sense. It often just blows me away to think that consciousness, which we don't understand yet, is a bunch of chemicals and atoms swirling around inside a piece of meat. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, there's this thing called consciousness. And no matter what you, if you think it's a delusion, whether you know, whatever you think about it, it's a phenomenon. Like it exists. You know what I mean? And yeah. And so, I don't think we maybe realize how much of a privilege and a gift it is, just in a sense, to be conscious, right? To be alive. I've often thought to myself, and this might go back to Bishop Berkeley, the idea of the tree falling in the forest. If there's no one there, you know, does it make a sound? If consciousness had never come about,
in a sense, would the universe even exist? Do you know what I mean? In a certain sense.
I don't know how to answer that question. The tree in the forest question or this one, I don't.
Yeah, well, neither do I, but it's definitely intriguing. But yeah, right. No, I think it's really...
But the reason that question came to my mind was we were talking about this episode we did with Thomas J. Ord, Open Theology, Process Theology, and how God is not omniscient. He's experiencing history along with us, that our choices, our experiences, he's living through with us. So that's where I got this idea. Are we playing an active role in God's own experience?
Well, this is a long-standing but not very well-explored problem in theology. For those of more of the Reformed tradition, there's a lot of emphasis often on God's self-sufficiency. You know, God doesn't need us. He created us out of pure love. He decides to bestow his love on us, but he's complete in himself. However, counter to that, if we didn't exist, how would God have the experience of loving another, you know, a complete other, something that's not God? Could he have that experience if we didn't exist? So in some sense, do we feel something in God too? I mean, and then you start to get into these sticky areas, right? But nonetheless, you know, yep. that's you know, you hear what I'm saying.
Right. Okay, Scott, we were going to do all of this in one episode. We were going to listen to David Makepeace and our two scholars, and here we are already at, I think it's over 50 minutes. So we're going to divide this into two parts. We're going to listen to our scholars next week, and they're going to help us dive more deeply into this topic. Again, we've got two experts, both of them with a PhD training in the psychological sciences. The one is a career scientist, an experimental psychologist, to be precise, and the other one's a theologian. So they're going to give us two very different perspectives on this question of awe and the religious or spiritual experience. And we've got a few specific questions we want to ask them. I'm curious about. We want to ask them why humans would have evolved this complex emotional response, or for the theologian, why might the divine choose to equip humans with this complex emotional response? I also want to ask experimental psychologists whether this is part of a complex suite of brain software. We heard from an experimental psychologist about a year ago about some other cognitive tools, the promiscuous teleology detector and the hyperactive agency detector. And we talked about that about a year ago, or a year and a half ago. It was episode number 78, how those two work together to, and maybe together with this emotion of awe, they work together to predispose humans towards religion-making and religiosity. And the other question I want to ask these experts is, if this emotion of awe is in part behind why some people are so drawn to intelligent design, that's what I mentioned at the beginning of the episode, it seems to give them an answer to the breathtaking and awe-inducing complexity of the genetic code. I wonder if that's why they're so passionate and committed to intelligent design.
I'm going to interject, Luke, that you yourself, I think, I'm sure on the podcast, but I know between us in conversations, on the one hand, you look at your scientists, you look at these things materialistically, right? You look at them, right. You know, and as a scientist, that's the right way to look at it. But you've also told me that when you stand back a little bit, and you really think about the millions of components that are going on in a single human cell, You are struck with awe. There is a sense that you have of transcendence, maybe.
Absolutely. I don't know if I use the word transcendence, but certainly awe. I am gobsmacked when I look at what goes on inside the cells. And what I have said is I just find it so hard to believe that that's a complete random accident.
Right.
I find that hard to believe.
Yeah,
but I don't want to say, so God snapped his fingers and made it.
Right,
I think there will be a day when we learn how all these things came together. And that still doesn't mean, to me, it doesn't mean that there's no God. But
no, it doesn't lessen the awe
right.
at all, to me at all. Like the fact that you know how something is made, like my son's into watches. So take a Rolex watch, and these cost $20,000. And you watch a documentary on how these watches are made, and you find out that typically, I think it takes a year to 2 years to make a single watch.
Oh.
And all the processes and intricacies that go into making that watch. And when you're done watching that, you're not less in awe of it.
Right.
You're kind of more in awe of it, right?
Yes.
So knowing how something comes about doesn't necessarily mitigate against that. I don't
think. Right. Okay. So we're going to ask these guys, again, the scholars, an experimental psychologist and a theologian, is this awe behind the commitment that intelligent design people have towards that way of thinking? We also want to ask them if this is also behind why other people who have given up their faith, and we sometimes will refer to ex-evangelicals, they still want to hang on to the label spiritual, but not religious. And maybe there's some kind of a tie in there. We're going to ask our experts that question as well. So tune in again next week, folks.
Yeah, looking forward to those discussions.
You've been listening to Recovering Evangelicals with your hosts, Luke Jansen and Scott Dyer. Send your comments and suggestions for new episodes to lukejjansen@gmail.com. Join our private discussion group on Facebook by searching for the Recovering Evangelicals podcast group. Look for the logo that you always see at your favorite podcast catcher and ask to be let in. Subscribe to lukejjansen.wordpress.com if you want to get advanced releases and group posts. Or browse through our archive for a full listing of all our previous episodes. And please help the podcast by sharing with a friend and leaving a review at your favorite podcast catcher.